All right, here we go. Night of the Living Dreads, episode 27. Got a good one for you today, folks. Went and saw the new Pet Sematary. Going to talk a little bit about that. Going to talk, well, no spoilers, of course, for those who haven't seen it. And going to talk a little bit about reboots in general and how we may unfairly criticize them. As well as an article I came across, 12 surprisingly plausible fan theories about the Halloween movie series. And I'm a big Michael Myers guy, so I thought that'd be interesting and bring about some good talking points. As well, bringing back this week's SMF. Let's get it started. Welcome once again, horror fanatics, to the Insane Asylum. I'm Otis B. Dredge. This is the Night of the Living Dreads podcast, the podcast where we talk all and anything horror. As I mentioned, I'm Otis B. Dredge, and this is episode 17. Boy, I'm taking some away. Some maybe should have been taken away. Episode 27. And as you heard in the very beginning there, before that groovy little intro music, I kind of dig it. It's pretty heavy, gets us all pumped up. Going to talk a little bit about it. Just went here recently, actually last night, and watched the new Pet Sematary. There's a few more reboots coming out, so I want to talk a little bit about that. But don't worry, you won't have to skip past any of the podcasts. I'm not going to, say anything that's going to spoil it. Just going to give my opinion without giving out any details of the movie for those who haven't seen it. And talk a little bit about, sometimes I think we unfairly judge reboots. And I get it, because reboots, they haven't really held their own water in the past. But we're going to talk a little bit about comparing the reboots and the remakes with the originals and how that can maybe backfire a little bit. As well as I came across an article want to talk about this because I thought it would bring up some good talking points. 12 surprisingly plausible fan theories about the Halloween series. And this was interesting. Some of these I can get behind. Others I'm like, you were kind of reaching here. But before we get into all that, and of course, as mentioned, past couple weeks, I don't think we had an SMF. This week, I stumbled across this guy who fits the bill quite well. But before we get into all of that and get into this week's SMF, got to give out a little bit of love and got to do a real quick like because I got a lot to talk about. Of course, Gore Hounds of Horror on Facebook. Need to check them out. They are the best damn horror group on Facebook. And another one that I frequent, and that would be the Misfit Horror Fiend Club. Hey, if you're a Misfits fan and you like horror, would sometimes kind of go hand in hand. At least it does with me. That's where you want to be. Go over there, sign up to both of them, tell them Otis sent you. Nothing big will happen. You just tell them Otis sent you. I don't know what that means, honestly. But and also there's another one, horror related, After Dark. And if you like doing the watch parties and watching maybe horror movies that you are not familiar with, or some that maybe you are, and you just want to hang out and a little watch party. They do a lot of that of those over there at After Dark, and I think I might have even seen a few over there at Misfit Horror Fiend Club. So awesome horror groups. As well as I've been trying to here the past few weeks to throw out this one non-horror group, but it is kind of run by the same people who run the best damn horror group on Facebook. And this group would be Cannabis Arcade. And Cannabis is with a K. Arcade is spelled just how you know it to be. If you're pot friendly, and again, we are here in the Insane Asylum, and you like to laugh, you like jokes and music and video games, if you're one of those gamers, and I am, I'm not even going to lie, who likes to, you know, engage in some plants, play some video games, and have a good laugh, that's where you want to be, Cannabis Arcade. And so there you go. There's the little Facebook rundown giving out some love. So I think, because I'm excited kind of to get into this guy, because this guy's pretty interesting, and hopefully nobody's, you know, heard of him. That's kind of been the what we're trying to do with this week's SMF is throw somebody out there that you are not too familiar with. So you may not hear things about Ted Bundy or, you know, some of your more well-known serial killers or you know, SMFs. You're going to hopefully hear people that you haven't heard of, maybe, you know, get you to look into it if that's your thing. It is our thing here in the Insane Asylum. So without further ado, this week's SMF.
Oh, you sick motherfucker!
This week's SMF, Richard Francis Cottingham. Not Cunningham. I'm not talking about little Richie from Happy Days, no, not at all, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, if you're new to the podcast and you're not familiar with this week's sick motherfucker, otherwise known as this week's SMF, then let me give you a quick rundown on what we do here on this little segment. We basically give you a brief little overview of hopefully a sick motherfucker, and of course, most of them, all of them really, have been pretty much serial killers, serial rapists, just some sick motherfuckers. So, we just give you a quick rundown. This isn't a complete, you know, history SMF 101, not at all. Just giving you a little bit of ammo, some seeds to plant. And maybe if you're into this kind of stuff, you'll check it out. But yeah, once again, this week's sick motherfucker is Richard Francis Cottingham, Cotting Ham. And this sick motherfucker was born November 25th, 1946. And nothing spectacular, really, you know, about his early childhood. He was given several nicknames, though, as he got older. One should have been Santa Claus, because this guy right now is 72 years old. He was given some nicknames, though. One was not Santa Claus, but one was the Torso Killer, the Butcher of Times Square, the New York Ripper, and the Times Square Torso Ripper. They just kind of combined it all right there. They figured, man, this I guess they couldn't come up with a new name, so they figured, well, we'll just take, you know, little bits of the last three names we gave them, and, you know, except for Butcher. But he was given these names because he took and dismembered his victims, and a lot of times only left the torsos behind. Yes. He was known to target prostitutes in Times Square, and we're talking about the early 70s. They say his crime spree, murder spree, was from 67 to, I believe it was 1980, but that's not entirely true. And we'll get into some of that because there was a lot of non-activity going on between 67 and 77. More accurately, the bulk of his crimes happened between 77 and 80. So he was given these nicknames, and he was officially known to have killed six people. He claims to be responsible for 85 to 100 murders. He is now incarcerated the New Jersey State Prison in Trenton, New Jersey. Now, as I mentioned, not a lot really, as you see with a lot of serial offenders that we've mentioned on this week's SMF or that we featured on the podcast, a lot have some really disheveled and bad backgrounds. Abuse at you know, whatever level. But nothing that I've come up with that I have found, because there's a little bit out there. A lot of it is just repeating what the source you read before said, but maybe in different words. So, again, he's not really one of those guys that, you know, oh, yeah, oh, no, Cottingham, yeah, the Santa Claus-looking guy. Oh, I know all about him. He don't sit up there with Bundy on the pedestal of serial killers. But he, so nothing really, you know, big happened in his childhood. We're going to jump right to his killing spree. Now, his first known murder, which he later admitted to, was the strangulation, it's about 67, 68, the strangulation of Nancy Vogel. She was 29 years old and a married mother of two. Her nude body was found in her car in Ridgefield Park, New Jersey. She had been last seen 3 days earlier when she left her home to play bingo with her friends at a local church. Isn't that how it, you know, I don't know, it just always seems, you know, like the victims a lot of times are just going to do these really just, you know, good, wholesome type things and end up coming across, going to church to play bingo, and runs across the fucking devil. 1977, things got a little out of hand for old Dickie, Tricky Dick. Mary Ann Carr crossed his path, and she was a nurse, an X-ray tech. And she went missing in 77. Now, no, I don't think there's a whole lot of details as far as how them two did cross paths, whether he was stalking her like so many other serial killers do. They go on a stalking. They start, a casing certain neighborhoods and things of that nature. Her body was discovered, a missing persons report went out, and her body was discovered in a parking lot of a motel in New Jersey. When she was found, she had a white nurse's coat on, and she had ligature marks on her wrist and ankles. They seem to the investigators and to the police, to the sheriffs, that these marks on her wrist and ankles seem to be pretty indicative to those marks that would be left by really tight handcuffs and you know, the person maybe trying pulling and leaving marks. So they were pretty sure, pretty positive, I should say, from what I've seen, that these were handcuffs used. And there were also ligature marks on her neck. This was the first victim. And again, nobody had any clue, what was going on. This is technically his second murder. His first one, as I mentioned, he later on admitted to, confessed, I should say, to the murders of, or the murder in 1967-68, Vogel. And at one point, after this murder of Marianne Carr, you know, he was working as a computer operator for, I believe it was Blue Cross Blue Shield. Yes, Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, and had actually been working there from 1967 up until the day of his arrest. And so he's a big computer guy. I mean, you know, it's been stated that, you know, if you were a computer operator in New York for Blue Cross Blue Shield, at that time, I mean, even 66 and you know, the mid-70s, early 70s, that was a pretty big deal. I mean, they were just kind of, you know, every home didn't have a computer in it. You know, I mean, it wasn't like today, obviously. So it was a pretty big deal for him, you know, to be involved in that. But where was I going with that? Well, one of his coworkers, who had, you know, worked by him for years, always, I mean, they were kind of like partners. They were working on little projects and this and that, and they talked a lot, as coworkers do. You know, you feel comfortable, your coworker, you may, you know, share some things that you probably wouldn't put out there a whole lot to, you know, other people that, you know, maybe you didn't trust so much or didn't spend as much time with. And he shared some things with his coworker, and you know, some being about his fascination and his love of S&M. And how he would go to these places and get tied up, and he was, you know, by a dominatrix and was, you know, made to lick urine out of off a urinal, or lick a urinal. So I'm sure there was piss in it or something. And so, you know, he's telling his coworkers these things, and it was all seemed kind of benign. Yeah, okay, whatever, man, you're weird, whatever, let's get back to work, kind of thing, is how his coworkers kind of took him. He also made the admission that he had contracted VD from a prostitute, because he along with the old S&M and getting tied up and licking pissers, he expressed his, you know, fondness of prostitutes, and how he would visit these areas. Now, again, Times Square, very different from today, back in the, you know, mid to late 70s, early 70s. It wasn't, you know, a big thriving, money-making, big place like it is now. There was actually just wall-to-wall, you know, whorehouses, and, I mean, the strippers were everywhere, and, I mean, it was almost damn near Skid Row. Maybe not to that level, but it wasn't, you know, probably what you would think it would be. So, again, a lot of hookers, you know, a lot of things going on there. So, he would frequent these, you know, prostitutes, pick them up, and blah, 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 and he contracted VD, and his coworker said that while he's telling that story, and from that point on, he seemed to have, anytime he talked about these hookers and prostitutes, that he always seemed to, you know, start seething with anger, and he just get mad, and he's talking to me, just such anger towards these prostitutes. Now, if you catch VD from a prostitute, when I first heard this, I was watching it with Mrs. Dreds. I made the comment, and, you know, pretty much all in a joking manner, but he had a right to be mad. I mean, a prostitute is the oldest profession, as they say, prostitution, the oldest profession. You would think that the oldest profession would have a clean environment. And so, you know, if you walk into a McDonald's, or, well, why would you do that? But if you, any business you walk into, if it's filthy and you catch a disease when you walk in, you're not there. You're not going to get much business if you're that business owner. So he was angry because, hey, you know, this prostitute wasn't keeping a clean environment. At any rate, after Marianne Carr in 77, On December 2nd, 1979, a fireman in New York responded to an alarm at a little hotel near Times Square. And again, these are rundown hotels. These are like your little no-tell motel type deals, you know, your little crack havens that you will call now. I mean, just rundown, just not high class, okay? They finally, when they were able to take and force their way inside and put out the fire, they came across something else I don't think they were expecting. You know, I'm sure being in these motels, you get a lot of drug addicts and, you know, things of that nature, and you're burning shit and whatever. Stretched out on the beds were two headless corpses. The bodies also had their hands removed, and they had been doused with lighter fluid and set alight. Oh, this guy was a sick motherfucker. The missing body parts were never found, or body part were never found. But once x-rayed, one victim was identified as D-Day Gudarzi. She was a 22-year-old immigrant from Kuwait who was working as a prostitute. The other headless corpse was never identified. Again, that was 1979, December 2nd, to be exact. And homicide detectives linked the murder, though. They did have something to go by a little bit. They linked the murder back to the murder of a teenage hooker named Ellen Sykes. Now, her body had, or she had gone missing, I should say, back in January of 79. So, I mean, just about a year before. When she was found, very similar circumstances. When she was found, her head, they say, was hanging by a thread. Her legs had been cut off, and they weren't left with the body. They were eventually found about a block away from the rest of her body. And the odd thing is this guy apparently took these legs, moved them about a block away from the body they came from, and laid them on the ground as if they were attached. They weren't just like thrown into a dumpster. They were very carefully laid down as if, you know, you were laying down on your back how your legs would be. That's how he laid the legs out, as if it were still attached. Well, May of, or the 5th of May, I should say, 1980, police found another prostitute. Now, you can probably see and understand the hatred this guy. Don't know if it came from VD, that he hated prostitutes. But again, I'm just here to give you a little rundown, and it's up to you if you want to know more. So you can see the similarities, though, with Jack the Ripper and why they called him the New York Ripper, because of the similarities going after the mutilations, that was involved in the Jack the Ripper case. And we did do a podcast on that. So, jump over there if you're interested. And Night of the Living Dreads, dreadswithnoa.com. And you can check that out, the Jack the Ripper podcast. There's a lot of similarities here, except for the death toll. How ironic. I say death toll, and I hear sirens going by. There's another one. Police found another prostitute, though. On May 5th, 1980, Valerie Streets, dead in a motel room. She had been beaten and strangled and then stuffed under the bed. She had been given one hell of a beating, they say, though, because he had been chewing, apparently, on her nipples, and he just about severed one. He was chewing on this woman's nipples. This murder, though, was linked to an earlier murder in the same motel, and that would be the one that we've already spoke of. The same motel that they found Marianne Carr, when she was in the parking lot. Now they have kind of a link here. They don't know if it's the same person, but they kind of have a link. On May 15th, just about a week and a half later, this guy don't waste time. Another prostitute was found murdered in a motel room. Jean Rayner, she was stabbed to death in a motel near Times Square. Her breast, and before I get into what he did, because the last one, he just about severed one with his teeth, one of her nipples, that is. This one's just a little bit more gruesome. He had told this same coworker that he, you know, was telling about his after work extracurricular activities, that, you know, he was really attracted to breasts, to really big breasts. Now, it said that he was saying it more like he was just attracted to the tits themselves. He was obsessed with them. Not so much obsessed or attracted to the female whose tits they belong to. No, he was kind of just infatuated with a big tit. So in this particular murder, her breast, her being Jean Rayner, her breast had been hacked off of her body. Just gone. And, well, she was set on fire. Now, this time, they were able to start linking some things together and started realizing, hey, this may, in fact, just be the same guy. All the MOs are starting to line up. And it's kind of seeming like the same guy. A week later, I told you, this guy works quick. A week later, police were called to the very same fucking motel. This time it was for a disturbance. There wasn't no dead body. It was just a disturbance. Apparently someone had called. They heard a bunch of screaming. And I think one of the persons who had called had even said that the screaming was sounding like, you know, a woman was being hurt or even tortured. And so, of course, you know, police arrive, and as they get there, they catch a guy trying to leave the room. And when they got into the room, they found this girl who witnesses and bystanders had heard scream. She was handcuffed to the bed. Of course, hysterics. And going on about, you know, of course, what the guy did, and that she had been beaten and raped and sodomized and forced at knife point to give the man a blowjob. He also stabbed her and bit almost right through her nipples. So very similar CMO as, you know, a couple murders ago. But Richard Francis Cottingham was arrested for the attack. And when he was arrested, though, his possessions included things like handcuffs, a leather gag, two slave collars, a switchblade, a replica pistol, and a bunch of pills. They were able to, obviously, get a search warrant, and they went to his house. Now, at his house, now, I guess I should let you know that he was a married man, okay? He was married, actually, from 70 to 79, a woman by the name of Janet, and he had three kids. But he got divorced in 79, so this did not occurred during their marriages. Although some of these, you know, the 60, you know, the Marianne Carr occurred during their marriage. And depending on when they got married or divorced, I should say, possibly the, I'll be pretty sure maybe the December 2nd, 79. But anyway, they get into his house. And the reason I wanted to bring that up, that he was married, is because it was said that you go down into the cellar, into the basement there, and there was a room that was, you know, pretty much under lock and key, and he told his wife, his kids, you know, no, nobody goes in there. Very adamant about that. Well, what they found was what would be called in the realm of serial killers, a trophy room. He kept personal things from the victims. And it said at this time, his wife had just recently filed for divorce. So I think he said because, you know, he was maybe known to be a regular at gay bars. Who knows? Who knows what the background of the divorce was? But thankfully, I guess, good for her, she was able to. But anyway, so his arrest, and I just have to scroll down just a little bit. This guy was, well, as we said, a sick motherfucker. He did try, though. That being when he got arrested, was that last incident with the 18-year-old. Her name, by the way, was Leslie Ann O'Dell. And she was a prostitute. But a little more detail into that was, he said that, wow, okay, May 22nd, 1980. Old Tricky Dick picked up an 18-year-old. That would be Odell. And at some point, you know, she agreed through their conversation to, you know, have sex for $100. So around dawn, it says, they checked into the same Hasbrook Heights motel where he had left his last mutilated victim. So he's kind of going back, you know, and using these same motels. He's very strange, but not, you know, so strange if you're a serial killer, because there are a lot of times creatures of extreme routines when they're committing their crimes. It said that Odell rolled over on her stomach after Cottingham offered to give her a massage. Straddling her back, he drew a knife and put it in her throat, as he placed a pair of handcuffs on her wrist. Again, same MO. He then began to torture her, nearly biting off one of her nipples, as I mentioned. She later testified that he said, "You have to take it. The other girls did. You have to take it too. You're a whore, and you have to be punished." And then again, as I mentioned, I don't need to rehash that. He was then arrested and not let out of custody, and he's got life in prison. And ladies and gentlemen, that's what this week's SMF. This week's SMF in the bag. It's time to take a little break. Hope you like this little musical break, I should say. Gonna talk after the break about, well, my opinion of the new Pet Sematary movie, and it's not really a bad one. And don't worry, I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. No details of the movie. And I also want to talk a little bit about how people kind of unfairly compare, you know, some of these reboots with the original, and kind of gives the reboots a bad name. Sometimes it's deserved. Other times I think it's just something we do impulsively. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the show, I got a nice little Talking Points article, some theories brought about by fans of the Halloween series, some theories that I don't know. Again, it's good Talking Points. All right, enjoy this little musical ditty, The Ramones, Pet Cemetery.
Under the Ark Double with the steamboats, ancient goblins and wild lords come at the grand light making a stand. The smell of death is all around. And at night when the cold wind blows, no one cares, nobody knows. I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery. Addicted to the sacred place. This ain't a dream, I can't escape. Moldings and fangs, the clicking of bones. Spirits moaning among the tombstones. And at night when the moon is bright, someone cries something ain't right. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. My life again. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. I feel a chill. Victor is grinning, flesh is riding away. Skeleton dance, I curse these days. And at night when the wolves cry out, listen close and you can hear me shout. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. Oh no. Oh no. I don't want to live my life again.
God, I love me some Ramones. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Excuse me. Night of Living Dreads podcast. I'm Otis B. Dreads. And, I love me some Ramones. I do. I have since I was a teenager. That was Pet Cemetery. Quite fitting because, I want to talk a little bit, again, no spoilers. I want to talk a little bit about the new movie. I just went and saw that last night. And I personally was pleasantly pleased. I mentioned in Gorehounds of Horror over there on Facebook, I was thoroughly enjoyed it. And I did. Again, I'm not going to give out any spoilers. What happens, I will just say it was, in my opinion, creepier than the first one. It was, I think it had a better ending than the first one. And I will leave it at that. If I was given a grade rating, I'm giving it a solid B. So the new Pet Cemetery, I personally, your friend Otis B. Dreads, would suggest giving it a shot. We're all going to have different opinions, okay, on especially reboots. And that's what I kind of want to talk about for a minute before I get into these theories about the Halloween series. You know, that we always, when we hear the word reboot, I know I do. I can't say we, I can't speak for everyone, but I know when I hear the word reboot of an older movie, older horror movie, I kind of get that, I don't know. And that's because I think that reboots don't really have, you know, a good track record. There have been some that are good. There have been some that, well, the directors probably should have been shot, or whoever came up with the concept to reboot that particular movie should have been shot. So I get that. And we're all going to have criticisms. I do. I'm guilty as charged. Before I get into this, you know, little mini rant, I'm guilty as charged, especially on this podcast. You can go back and hear it. So I can't say I don't do this, because you guys can go back and listen to older podcasts where Malice and myself discuss some movies. I call them complete shit. Don't waste your time. You'll never get that time back type thing. You know, shit on the actors, blah, blah, blah. But I kind of leave it at that. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, you can have a bad actor and a good script, and, you know, he can maybe make it work. But if you have a bad actor, bad script, yeah, it's a recipe for disaster. That, to me, was not the case with Pet Sematary. So, again, go check that out. But what I find that people do, and you know, I'm going to go over a few reboots. One that I was just... it was just brought to light to me through a little bit of research and some articles I came across. I'm going to get into some 2019 reboots of old classics. But the problem I see is people, a lot of times, they overly judge a reboot based on the original. And as mentioned by one of the moderators, good old Chad at Gorehounds of Horror on Facebook. You know, I too, as Chad said, would like to take that word original and shove it up those who use that all the time's ass. Because I think you kind of do maybe a disservice, in a sense, to a reboot. If you overly compare it to the original. Now, I mean, what do people want when, you know, they hear of a reboot? Or if you hear people say, yeah, I would love to see so-and-so, you know, remake this movie, reboot, you know, this old classic, blah, blah, blah. What do you want, a frame for frame? Do you want everything to be exactly the same? That's not going to happen. And if that was the case, why would you watch it? Because a newer version means exactly that. It may be a reboot of an old classic, but it's still, you know, going to have little things that make it just slightly different, but keep within the main plot of the original movie. Now, to me, if you overcompare... if you overcompare reboots with the originals, you're distorting your perception of the movie. Could we not watch reboots in a way that it's almost like we're watching this movie for the first time as if it's not a reboot? Can we go into a movie that's being remade of an original and not think of the original? I know that's hard, because it's almost inevitable that we're going to have some slight comparison. In our head, we're going to be thinking, okay, is this going along with the storyline? Is this that? Is this that? Oh, okay, great. For one, I don't really need in the remake or a reboot the actors to look like the originals. Now, I have mentioned when I see movies about serial killers, yes, I do like the person portraying the serial killer to look like the person he's portraying. Sorry, Kane Hodder playing Ed Gein seemed really weird to me. Didn't seem like it fit. Two different physiques. It just didn't work. Good movie, though. I mean, just didn't work in that aspect. But do you want a frame for frame? Do you want this to be exactly like the original? And if that's the case, what's the point of making one? There's going to be little things that set a reboot apart from the original. For one, a lot of these, you know, originals were back in maybe the 70s, the 80s, maybe early 90s, whenever they came out. So things are a little bit different now in the horror movie making genre. There's better special effects. Of course, you know, you have all the, you know, computers involved and things of that nature. So things are going to take a little bit of a different turn with a reboot. So I guess basically to sum it up, what I'm saying is try going to watch reboots. Now here's one. But before I sum this up, I was not a huge fan of the original Chucky back in 88, I think it was, 89. I was not a huge fan of it. Just something about killer dolls, you know, being killed by a little, you know, foot and a half, 2 foot, you know, doll. Why couldn't you punt that little bastard through the window? So it didn't really freak me out. But after watching, but before that, even, you know, after coming up with that opinion of Chucky, I never really dove into the Chucky franchise. After seeing, and I wasn't even looking forward to the new Chucky coming out, but after seeing one of these trailers, I don't know if it's the latest one, but after seeing this trailer, me and Mrs. Dredge watched it, and we both had the same opinion. We both kind of looked at each other like, I don't know. That kind of looks pretty damn good, possibly better than the original. So what I'm trying to get at here is, with me, a lot of times a reboot can ignite the want to see the originals, even though I didn't originally like them. It may get me going back and watching, you know, even parts of movies within a franchise that I hadn't seen before because I didn't like the first one or the second one that came out. Maybe I'll watch more after that, after watching a reboot. Sometimes reboots can be better. Sometimes they simply do justice to the original, and I have to say, I believe that Pet Sematary, you know, did some justice. There's going to be people that, you know, out there is going to say, oh, well, the acting wasn't there, that, you know, I didn't like, you know, John Lithgow, you know, playing, you know, the role of Judd, and, well, you know, are we, you know, just a nation of Siskel and Eberts? I mean, none of us are making films that are at least probably listening to my podcast. And if you are, hit me up. I would love to look at some of your stuff. But most of us are probably not out there actively writing scripts, making films. So they kind of got one up on us, even if, you know, it does suck. Even if certain movies do suck, they got one up on us. So I give it a little bit of a open arms reboots, even though I know, and in my mind, a lot of them, you know, just simply blow. But hey, that's neither here nor there. But check it out, Pet Sematary. There's a lot of good ones coming out this year. 2009 reboots. I just found out about this one. Firestarter. Oh, yeah. Little old Drew Barrymore. You know, another Stephen King. Speaking of Pet Sematary, it's in its early stages, so there's not a lot of information that's out right now about the, you know, production and things of that. But there is a director, there is a writer, and it is said that a schedule release could be in 2019. Another one, The Blob. Now, this has been remade before, the, you know, going way back, you know, the original, and then we had a mid to late 80s remake. Now here's another remake, and it's said that Samuel Jackson will be in this one. Motherfucker, motherfucking blob. Sick of all these blobs on this motherfucking plane. And so that's something to look forward to. Okay, are we going to compare that one to the original and then shit on it? Because, well, and I have to admit that I have read that this version of The Blob, this 2019 version of The Blob, is actually made more as a science fiction than it is a horror movie. But, you know, it kind of has, I guess, both aspects. I believe that's the one, John Landis. He do that one. I don't want to. Anyway, all right. I was thinking in my head. The last but not least, and I'm actually looking forward to this one too. And this one may not be out until possibly early. No, it's actually this one, American Werewolf in London. Remember that one, folks? I believe 1981. Early 80s there, and I believe that was the one John Landis directed. Boy, I had all kinds of tabs up on on my computer, and boom, gone. All right, here we are. I think I found it over here at the IMDb. .com, American Werewolf in London. Yes, Max Landis, John Landis's son, is going to be remaking this 1981 classic. And again, this is over there at the IMDb.com site. And it states, as she travels through the UK with her boyfriend, so it's not two dudes. Now it's, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, she, I guess, or boyfriend, Alex, could be either, is bitten by a werewolf. So, kind of holds, you know, true to, I guess, you know, obviously, the plot. And so this is just, again, in the early stages, The Blob, another one right here on this list. So, with some of these classics coming out this year, should we really, you know, just, you know, can't we just change the way maybe we look at some of these remakes, reboots, however you want to put it, rebakes? Anyway, check them out. I mean, hey, and watching a movie, a horror movie in a theater is, it's really cool. And I know a lot of you have done this. I think it's better than sitting at home. Yeah, you're going to pay some outrageous prices, but hey, you got to live. Got to live. So, all right, we're going to get into this one, which I thought would bring about possibly some good talking points after this here shitstorm is posted and out there. 12 surprisingly plausible fan theories about the Halloween series, and this I came across, and lo and behold, again, one of our other mods, Eric, over there at Gorehounds of Horror, posted this. I had to thank him because it was an interesting read, and I, if most people don't know, am a straight-up Michael Myers guy. Love me some Myers, and I was immediately attracted to this one. So we're going to go through 12 theories that fans put together that maybe are, you know, they're just theories, basically. Again, good talking points. Here we go. Starts right off. Number one, Dr. Loomis is actually the same Loomis from Psycho. Now listen to this. In this theory, the name Sam Loomis is more than just an homage to the iconic horror film and subtle reference to Jamie Lee Curtis's pedigree. Now think about what would a bereft Sam Loomis do after failing to save his girlfriend in Psycho? Maybe he decides to combat psychosis by going back to school and becoming a psychiatrist. He then decides to start fresh in Illinois, where he is assigned to treat a young boy who just murdered his sister. The theory actually, and this is what I'm reading the article here, and this will be posted in the description. The theory actually makes so much sense that the only reason to doubt it is that John Carpenter hasn't confirmed it as truth. And I ain't going to go that far. But I think it does make a lot of sense. It really does. I don't believe this was in Carpenter's mind. Again, these are just things that fans thought up. But it makes a lot of damn sense. And wouldn't that be cool to have all of these horror films one day be all somehow connected? Think about that one. It explains why Loomis isn't like a normal psychiatrist. He feels a personal duty to try and stop Michael as if this is his second chance. So he couldn't bring down the killer that killed his girlfriend in Psycho. That'd be the shower scene. So now he goes back to school to try and combat psychosis, and then is assigned to the Michael Myers, okay? Now, when Michael escapes and starts murdering, it would only make sense that Loomis would go on a crusade to stop him with the same obsession as Ahab seeking his white whale. So, again, I think, yeah, that's a good one. Now, granted, all of these, Otis B. Dreads is not going to agree with. Now, here we go. Michael Myers has a congenital insensitivity to pain. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. The real condition, CIP, is basically the inability to feel pain. Taking stab wounds, bullets, third-degree burns, in stride, Michael doesn't seem to let pain hold him back. The absence of any pain indicator would also explain his complete lack of empathy for his victims. He also uses this condition to his advantage in his workout routine, putting in extra reps to get the strength of 10 gorillas. And why are they letting him use Smith Grove's sanitarium weight set at this point is another question. Number three, Michael Myers is autistic. Interesting. Some have suggested that Michael is autistic. He doesn't speak, exhibits repetitive, ritualistic behavior, is obsessive, and has problems with his motor skills. His obsession with the day Halloween could be attributed to a diagnosis of autism, as well as his compulsion to kill people in the same ways over and over. Though, of course, murder in itself is not an autistic trait. And that's the article, and I would have to agree. It's not saying because he murdered, he has to be autistic. No, not in the least. Michael seems to lack the ability to comprehend theory of mind. And that means that other people are living, thinking creatures, you know, just like you. Which is traditionally a defining characteristic of autism. His complete lack of empathy would seem to be the result of an extreme deficiency in that area. And, as Dr. Loomis says, quote, I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing, no reason, no conscience, no understanding, and even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, of good or evil, right or wrong. Now, yeah, I know a lot of people, and trust me, while I was reading through these, I'm thinking, man, people are, you know, really thinking deep. And I mean, these are really just movies. I mean, these are characters people, you know, wrote up, came up with, and, you know, I mean, it's just somebody's imagination, basically. You know, think maybe, are we thinking a little too deep? I don't know. Again, good talking points. Number four, Michael Myers' childhood mask was made by Silver Shamrock. This one makes too much sense, too, going back to the article here. This one makes too much sense, too. In Halloween 3, Seasons of the Witch, or Season of the Witch, we follow the Silver Shamrock Company, which uses killer mask as a ploy for a guy to usher in a new age of witchcraft. It has nothing to do with Michael Myers, or does it? According to this theory, the clown mask that Michael wears at the beginning of the original Halloween is a beta test of mask that we see in Halloween 3. The mask grants him immortality, that's why he can't be killed, but it has an unintended side effect of making him go crazy and kill his family and just about any other random person in his path. So, interesting. Again, number five, Michael Myers is a force of nature. In the original script, he was just the shape. There was no like human. There was no personification going on there. It wasn't like this person. It was just the shape, like a force of nature. Article states it could be that nothing about Halloween was meant to be taken literally. It was a movie, so, I mean. Thus, the film is an allegory for whatever force of nature is behind every random murder that we see on the evening news. You cannot, quote, kill this force like you can kill a psycho killer. It will simply manifest somewhere else in another form. Certainly, the film, Dr. Loomis, goes to great lengths to suggest that psychopathology is not a sufficient explanation for Michael's condition. John Carpenter himself has repeated this point. Michael was rather, quote-unquote, pure and simply evil. Dr. Loomis's conclusion is not meant to be taken as an indication that Loomis is a quack, but rather that psychiatry as a science cannot adequately explain that which is Michael Myers. So, again, this is, you know, a force in nature with autism, the inability to feel pain, with an evil mask on. Hey, man, sounds like a good horror movie. When are they going to make this one? Michael's purpose is to spread fear. Seems pretty, you know, right on. More than that, he's also or is possessed by a sloth. I can't even pronounce this, but it's an ancient Celtic spirit which emerged on Samhain. With Halloween being a Christianized version of the ancient Celtic holiday, it makes sense that such a spirit world would be involved. But it goes much deeper than that. Michael, with supernatural powers, exists to scare people. With his initial murder of his sister, scaring the town so badly that the house sat vacant for 15 years. Then when people stopped being afraid, as demonstrated by Laurie's fearlessly walking up to the house and depositing the key, it was time for Michael to return. His purpose wasn't just to kill Laurie, but to create fear anew, because the fear had subsided, and therefore he returns to reinvigorate that fear, which is why he built his own version of a haunted house at the Wallace's place. So, hey, convincing or not, I don't know. You tell me. I'd love to hear you guys' opinion. We're we're about halfway through now. And I'd love to hear you guys' opinions on some of these, if not all of them. Go ahead. Dr. Loomis is the real victim. Oh, here's where it gets weird. On his blog, Dead to Rights, writer Joe Blevins asked, is Dr. Loomis the franchise's real boogeyman? Blevins begins by reminding readers that John Carpenter has intended the first Halloween movie to be a standalone film. He says, the only information we had about these characters and the only information the creators ever intended us to have about them came from this one movie. End quote. Disregarding the later backstory additions, Blevins makes the case that the first time we see little Michael after stabbing his sister, his expression is one of shock and fear, not evil glee. Seems like he is appalled at his own actions. Wow. Okay. So where is this going? Blevins equates Loomis to another monomaniacal literary characters like Captain Arab and Dr. Frankenstein, suggesting that Loomis's obsession with Michael either intentionally or unintentionally turned him from a disturbed little boy who could be saved into a monster. Now, Blevins says, in my interpretation of Halloween, Dr. Loomis viewed the six-year-old Michael Myers as a personification of evil because that's what he wanted to see in the boy. Thus, Loomis's idea of Michael became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Treat him like a killer, and he becomes a killer. For 15 years, Michael was Loomis's own little science experiment, his own little Frankenstein monster. I can imagine Loomis telling Michael over and over again that he is evil and the devil himself, and constantly, constantly reminding him of the events in Haddonfield in 1963, end quote. That's what Blevins said. He even suggests that Loomis may have intentionally let Michael loose on Haddonfield and guided him on his murder spree. But, hey, what are you going to do? Here's one that kind of goes against the old autism theory. Michael can talk. We've never heard it, have we? In theory, Michael Myers can and does talk. He blends in, acting as several background characters throughout the series. Specifically in Halloween 4, he points out Ted Hollister in the bushes and gets the poor kid shot up. I mean, hey, he does love to lurk in the background of shots. That was the article. That wasn't my funny little banter, because I don't have funny little banter. Number 9, as most horror villains, well, some of the old 80s, of course, Michael Myers is triggered by sex. Walking in on your sister having sex would mess up any six-year-old kid. Having to deal with this constant. Yeah. Well, let me put it to you this way. And this is not the article. This actually, I think, probably makes more sense. It kind of goes right along to me with, you know, the story of Jason Voorhees. Drowned while counselors were, you know, partying, having sex, doing drugs. He drowns, people not paying attention to him. And therefore, he's always attacking while people are having sex and doing drugs. So this does make sense to me. It certainly seems, going back to the article, it certainly seems plausible enough on the surface. One night, Michael gets fed up and snaps, murdering his half-naked sister. He escapes his confinement at the mental institution on Halloween night and just tries to mind his own business at his abandoned house, only to find more teenage derelict babysitters shacking up. So then that brings back that anger and that feeling of being fed up right back to him. The only problem with this theory is that John Carpenter and Deborah Hill themselves have refuted this. They said that the sex theme was just a matter of practicality. The teens were too distracted by sex to effectively notice the killer stalking them, while Laurie Strode was better equipped to deal with the murder because, she wasn't so much of a whore. That was me. That wasn't the article. Number 10, Michael makes an appearance in American Horror Story. And this is interesting here. Now, this one and one coming up is going to kind of try and link Michael Myers with, American Horror Story and another horror classic. I won't say classic, but another horror movie. Fans of American Horror Story will remember little Michael Harmon, Constance's smiling, two-headed little grandson, who might also be the Antichrist. A murderous, maybe supernatural little psychopath named Michael? Interesting. Naturally, some have suggested that Constance might have bundled up her little angel after he gleefully murdered his nanny and moved them both to Illinois. Of course, as the article states, that leaves a lot to be unexplained. I mean, where do sisters come from? Constance, I don't know. He's not his mother. I mean, what's going on? It leaves a lot unexplained. That one we can probably wipe off. Here's an interesting one, and it's pretty absurd. Michael Myers is Chucky. Yes. Yeah, I swear. I said it. Michael Myers is Chucky. What if young Michael Myers was simply possessed by the spirit of Charles Lee Ray? Making the Child's Play series a set of prequels to Halloween. Perhaps earlier that fateful Halloween night, Charles Lee Ray finally succeeded in using voodoo to transfer his soul into the unwitting character of Little Mike, or unwitting carrier of Little Michael. Nah, gonna have to give that one a big no. The new Halloween film will be a crossover with Vice Principals. Now, I don't know anything about this show. Okay, and here's where it gets really, really just, you're reaching at this point. The HBO series Vice Principals got dark at the end of season one. Never seen it. And in this theory, it is about to get even darker. Danny McBride plays Neil Gamby in Vice Principals, and the very same McBride just so happens to be a co-writer on the new Halloween film being produced by Blumhouse, however you want to say it. Now imagine for a second that Laurie Strode entered a witness relocation program after the events of Halloween 2, the time when the new film is supposed to take place. Now, that's not actually true. The new film takes place 40 years after the first Halloween, after the event. How could it pick up after Halloween 2? Maybe it's a stretch to suggest that Laurie was relocated to the high school in Vice Principals, but whatever. So that wraps up that 12. Some are convincing. I'll give it some, not so much. And some are just, flat out fucking ridiculous. And I guess we'll leave it at that. Hey, I want to thank everyone for, joining in, visiting me here in the Insane Asylum. I'm Otis B. Dreads. Every Sunday, new podcast will be out. Work, life, sometimes doesn't allow that to happen on schedule. But I'm going to put as much effort as I can into making sure that you got a new one every Sunday. That is, if you even like listening to it. So, hey, with that being said, again, visit Gorehounds of Horror over there on Facebook. Visit Misfit Horror Fiend Club. Visit After Dark. And when you're feeling a little funny, maybe a little high, stop on over to Cannabis Arcade. And guess what? Night of Living Dreads, No A in Dreads, and Cannabis, by the way, with a K. No A in Dreads. Hey, we're over there on Facebook as well. NightOfLivingDreads.com to listen to this episode and all the other ones, the past 26. So, hey, we're getting up there in numbers. We got a little staying power. That's all right. So, again, I want to thank everybody for listening. Hey, we'll be back next week. I don't know what the hell I'm going to talk about. There's going to be some horror. All right. Otis B. Dreads out. Night of Living Dreads podcast.
Things no one knows. We're going to die.